Coming up in the show, what a magical 2025 it's been for Rory McIlroy. Wins at Pebble and the Players, the career Grand Slam, a homecoming for the ages, and now the ultimate team victory with Europe winning a Road Rider Cup. How does 2025 stack up among the best years of Rory's career? We're going to have more Ryder Cup reaction. What's been the secret to Team Europe's success? We're going to visit with a past European Ryder Cupper who will give his take on why the Europeans have been on a sustained run of dominance as Golf Today starts now.
Golf Today.
I've said this for the last probably 6 or 7 years to anyone that will listen. I think one of the biggest accomplishments in golf right now is winning an away Ryder Cup. And that's what we're going to do at Bethpage.
Go on, Rory.
Yeah, you got
what a tone setter 2 years ago for Rory to make that statement in the mere moments after winning the Ryder Cup in Rome in 2023. That's exactly what the European did on Sunday. Won the Ryder Cup at Bethpage Black, just the fifth win on foreign soil since 1979. First time we had seen an away Ryder Cup team win since the Europeans back in 2012 at Medina. So with that, we welcome you into this Tuesday edition of Golf Today. George Savarikas alongside Eamon Lynch. We're going to have so much more reaction to the Ryder Cup, what this year means to Rory McIlroy, but it's been an amazing ride with Rory to see his kind of thoughts on the Ryder Cup mature to now he's the lead voice for Europe. He says in 2023, we're going to go win a Road Ryder Cup. And that's clearly what the entire team was preparing for the second the 2023 Ryder Cup ended.
It's a long way from calling it an exhibition, isn't it? Which, in fairness, I think he was 18 or 19 years old at the time and had never played one when he made that comment. But there's a lot that's going on in Rory McIlroy's last couple of years that show kind of the arc of perspective that he's learned. And some of that's been pretty hard won over the last few years. But it does speak to, I think, to where they prioritise the Ryder Cup in terms of the European team. And one thing you noticed, you know, there was a lot of talk about Rory McIlroy saying we don't need to be paid to play, that we would pay to play the Ryder Cup. He made that comment almost a year ago in November when it was announced that the American team would be paid. The Europeans talk about the Ryder Cup all the time. It's not just whenever the FedEx Cup season ends and 3 weeks later you're playing the Ryder Cup. That seems to be when so much of the American focus is on it, when it forces itself into the players' consciousness. The Europeans have a constant ongoing dialogue with themselves. And that, I think, just creates a greater prioritization of the Ryder Cup in the minds of those guys.
And it certainly seems to be on a European perspective when you look at career accomplishments, that's higher up on the list. Ryder Cup record, how many winning teams, et cetera, than it would necessarily be on the American side. But that could just be the perception here versus what we see on the European side. So back in January, this was from Rory McIlroy. He said, winning the Masters, winning an Olympic medal, and another away Ryder Cup, those are the three goals for the rest of my career. Well, Rory didn't take too long to start checking off his lifelong goals that he was going to have for the rest of his career. In April, wins the Masters in thrilling fashion over his teammate Justin Rose, the playoff victory as he gets that elusive green jacket, completing the career Grand Slam. Amazing stuff, Aiden.
And he checked the second box just a few days ago, Sunday, when he and his European teammates beat the US by that 15-13 margin at Bethpage Black. He had an emotional interview afterwards with Cara Banks.
You said 2 years ago that winning a Ryder Cup on foreign soil was one of the hardest things to do in golf. Your team have done it. How proud are you in this moment?
Yeah, I am I'm extremely proud to be a part of this team. I'm extremely proud of every single one of the players, the VCs, the captain, all the backroom support staff. This was an unbelievable collective effort. As soon as we won in Rome, we turned our attention to trying to do something that everyone thought was pretty impossible to do, not just win in America, but win here in New York. It's been an amazing week.
You were emotional 4 years ago at Whistling Straits. I sense some emotion now, but how different are the feelings that you felt 4 years ago to the ones you're feeling now?
Yeah, just like to hear the ole oles here in America, to, you know, honestly, to do something that a lot of people thought that we couldn't do. I mean, what the comments and what people were saying after Whistling Straits about this decades of American dominance, you know, that was, we took a lot from that. We let that fuel us. We got so lucky in getting an incredible leader in Luke Donald. And, you know, he shepherded us through this whole process, and he's been absolutely amazing. A lot of the credit has to go down to him. 11 of the 12 players from Rome came back. We did what we needed to do, and we're going to celebrate like there is no tomorrow.
Celebrate like there's no tomorrow? He did. Shane Lowry, of course, center of attention. This on the European team bus on their way back to their hotel where the party went late into the night. And Rory McIlroy enjoying his share of the celebrations as well.
Trevor Ilman had a great tweet. He said, what foresight by Shane Lowry to have his pajamas already on so that wherever he ends up at the end of the night, he's already ready to just lay down and go to bed. And for Rory McIlroy, you couldn't dream up a better season and better venues than where Rory won at in 2025. Kicked it off with that win at Pebble, beginning of the season in February. A month later, wins the Players in March. Then in April, the Masters. Later over the summer, the Irish Open, wins that event for the second time, goes 3-1-1, was just one of the lead horses for the European side. What a Ryder Cup performance. So for Rory McIlroy, 4 wins worldwide, and you throw in the Ryder Cup, makes it 5. The only other comp would probably be 2014, where he had 4 wins worldwide, 2 majors, also won the Ryder Cup at Glen Eagles. But with how meaningful both the career Grand Slam and a road Ryder Cup were, where does this stack up among the best years of his career?
I think it's got to be right up there at the top, George. I mean, he's had years where he's obviously had a lot of wins. He's had years where he's won more majors, but I don't think he's had years where the wins have actually meant more on an individual basis. And you can throw in, obviously, the Irish Open into that as well, particularly in the circumstances he won it. You know, I had a text exchange at the start of this year with Rory McIlroy, and he laid out what he thought his 3 goals were for 2025. The first one was the Masters. The second one was the Open at Royal Portrush near his home. And the third one was the Ryder Cup. 2 out of 3 ain't bad on that. And he didn't win the Open at Portrush, but he did actually win the Irish Open, I suppose, a couple of hundred miles south of there. But he's, what you get the sense from him now is he's actually savouring these moments. He gave an interesting interview in the aftermath the Ryder Cup on Sunday, putting this in context for himself. It's worth listening to what he said.
It's the best year of my career, best year of my life. I think best year of my life on and off the course too. You know, I've got so many things to be grateful and lucky for away from the golf course. Beautiful wife, beautiful daughter. My parents are healthy. I've got a great support group, great friends. And that's the important thing. Like, this is amazing. This is obviously incredible what we're doing here, but when it's all said and done, I'm going to have those really important people in my life, and I feel so lucky for that.
And that's a guy at 36 who's taken a share of gut punches over the last few years, particularly inside the ropes when you think back of what happened at say, St. Andrews in 22 or Pinehurst in 24. It takes a certain resilience to get through that, but it also gives you a sense of appreciation when the good times start to roll again. And the good times are pretty much rolling for Rory McIlroy right now.
Yeah, and you could throw in 23 at LACC. It was right there, and it had happened 3 consecutive years. And it seemed like, when's he going to get over the hump? Is it ever going to happen, or is Rory going to be the close call guy for the rest of his career, at least in majors? Yeah. Bust out in a big way. Then the rest of the major season until Royal Portrush, he seemed to lose a bit of steam. But to win the Irish Open, and I was there in 2016, and I remember interviewing him when he won it for the first time. And you could see the emotion of playing back in Ireland and how that event would strike a different note with him. Yeah. But to do that and then layer on the Ryder Cup, not only is it a complete year for Rory, he seems to be so grounded where he is in life right now. To say on and off the course, loving wife, loving family, seems very content with where he is personally and professionally, which is
an incredible cross-section to have at 36.
And just the value of the people he has around him that he mentioned in that interview, the importance of that was actually shown recently, because we did have that period where he appeared to be lacking in certain motivation after the Masters, which is understandable if you climb a lifetime dream mountain. You wonder what comes next. And over at the Irish Open, he did actually say what had snapped him out of that, and it was Harry Diamond, one of his oldest friends, his caddy, who turned to him one day and said, well, you've got your career Grand Slam, that's great, I don't have mine. And suddenly Rory McIlroy's focus has now shifted again. OK, well, Harry's only gotten one major with Rory, there's another three to go. So the network he has around him do a very big part in keeping his feet on the ground, and I think you're seeing the fruits of that now, that they always believed that they were going to see a year that we're seeing now. And clearly, I don't think he's going to lack focus for next year based on what he's achieved this year either.
And I remember talking to him at the Travelers Championship, and it was right after U.S. Open, and you're waiting for Rory to get through the dark clouds that had followed him, which was odd, after the Masters. And I said, well, what do you need to feel to know that you're going to regain what you had at the beginning of the year? He said, excitement going to the course, and I think I'm there. And we saw that the last 3 months. He's excited again. It looks like the Rory from February to April that was on top of the world that thrills golf fans around the world, especially European fans last week.
Yeah, dark clouds are gone. The sun is shining now, George. Well, coming up, Rich Lerner spent the week out at Bethpage. We're going to find out what he saw, what he heard, and maybe a little bit of what he'd like to forget. Rich joins us after this. Rich with another front row seat to the action at Bethpage Black. And Rich joins us now. Rich, you've seen quite a few of these over the years. Where does this one rank for the good, the bad, and the ugly?
It had a little bit of all of it, didn't it, Eamon? And I don't think it's quite there with what we saw at Medina in 2012, but it was close. I mean, you know, we went to bed with the United States in a deep hole, but to their credit, they did not lay down on Sunday. And I did not think that at 5 o'clock on that afternoon, we would have zero interest in checking football scores. I don't think anybody was watching football. You know, at about 4 o'clock, I was looking up greatest sports comebacks, not just golf, but sports comebacks in history. And George, I think, could go chapter and verse on that, as good as he is at all sports. And if Shane Lowry doesn't make that putt, you just try for a second to imagine how the pressure escalates even more than it had already been ratcheted up. So it was a great Sunday. That essay you just ran was sort of an emergency essay. It was not the one that had been written, which was going to be extremely critical of the United States and how they go about all of this. So I maybe, you know, upon, you know, considering this further for all of the good, the bad, and the ugly, for all of it, you know, wrapped into one, then it's right up there. I suppose for raw excitement, I still think 2012 and even 99, those frantic, furious, frenetic comebacks are slightly ahead or right there. I'm not big into rankings, but this was about as ugly as I've seen. I for the life of me, I don't get it. I don't know why we have to tolerate it. You know, we sort of now our default position is, well, this is the way it is. Why? I think Brandel said yesterday they don't tolerate it at Augusta National, and I don't know why we have to tolerate it in this setting. And while we're on the subject of environment and you know, the Europeans create the conditions that make it more likely they're going to succeed. Why can't the PGA of America create the environment that allows this to come off where it is not crossing the line? I think, to use Paul McGinley's phrase, they need a root and branch review here. If you're going back even to Valhalla, I don't want to go too deep into it. That was a black mark. Let's not sugarcoat it. What happened in 2024 and what happened here in 2025. It's a wonderful organization in so many ways. They serve the game, all of us who love the game. But they have a lot to consider here with what went wrong. Why do we need the blaring music? You know, somebody said to me, that on the first tee, Eamon and George, they couldn't hear the chants. And that to them, the Ryder Cup, one of the great elements are those chants, the songs from the Europeans, the songs from the United States. They couldn't hear them because the music was so loud. I don't need rock concert music to get me hyped for a Ryder Cup. I just don't. In fact, it takes away. It's unoriginal. It's uninspiring. And we don't need it. Get rid of it. The comedian on the first tee, utter embarrassment. I'm bordering on a disgrace. So what are we doing? And I think that's a question that the PGA of America needs to be thinking about in the days ahead. So good. The good was obviously the Europeans, what the Americans did on Sunday, all credit to them for getting up off the mat. The bad would be, some of the Keegan Bradley pairings, the setup to the golf course. The great would be the European spirit. You guys had a phenomenal conversation on Rory McIlroy. I don't think there's any doubt this is his most memorable, most meaningful year. There's a bigness to Rory's, not just to Rory's game. There is a bigness to his spirit. There's a bigness to his dreams. There's a bigness to his capacity for inspiring other people. And all of that, I think, was on display. He is a stone cold legend of the game. And while, what they do individually really has no, what they do collectively in the team environment really doesn't have much of an impact on how they're viewed historically. It doesn't determine whether or not they go to the Hall of Fame. I do think it can burnish someone's legacy, and Rory understands that. And now that you got me talking and thinking, Eamon, for all that we have to talk about in the aftermath, there's probably never been one quite like this. So you got me there. Thank you.
I would say with Rory, it's been amazing to see. Remember, he was running on fumes at the 21 Ryder Cup, had a losing record, did not play well, apologetic in the aftermath. To then lead not one, two consecutive victories has been amazing. And for him to say, like the Tim Tebow, after losing to Ole Miss type declaration, we're going to win the Ryder Cup on the road at the winner's press conference in 23, I thought was an amazing declarative statement to make and then to follow through. The flip side, though, Rich, and I want to get to the U.S. side, because the final margin, in my opinion, was deceiving. It was a fun Sunday to watch. Data Golf at the peak, I think the U.S. still had a 12% chance of winning. So it was like being down two touchdowns, scoring one late, trying an onside, not getting it. You lose by a touchdown. You're never fully in it. And it's now dating back to 1993, the last time the Americans have won on the road. They're going to Ireland in 2027. I was 8 years old the last time they won on the road. So this has been a very one-sided affair. The President's Cup was launched in 94. The U.S. side plays a team competition every year. The Europeans gear up and spend 2 years focusing on the Ryder Cup. Does the President's Cup have any impact on the U.S. Ryder Cup performance?
Maybe. I don't know that it's too much. I don't think it should be, but I understand the argument. I think it has to do more with the approach here. I said this earlier in the week. The Europeans have a sophisticated, holistic operation. It is an operation with a full-time and, frankly, ruthless CEO in Luke Donald. Leaves no stone unturned. The United States doesn't have that. They're wayward. I just don't think they know where they want to go. And I think Keegan Bradley is sort of evidence of that. And I try to say this respectfully because I do think Keegan tried his best. I think he did some good things. But to appoint a 39-year-old captain who's a 13th-ranked player of the world who is on a full-time basis competing and ask him to handle the Ryder Cup as well, I think that sets you up for a mismatch. And I think philosophically, it has more to do with the philosophical approach, that this does, it seem, to mean more to the Europeans. And I'll go back to, I did an event with Paul and Brandel last night, and Paul said really that the essence of their approach in Europe is very simple. He says, we try to make this fun for the players. Now, that sounds simple. After that, it is all about creating the conditions for this to be fun. Chemistry matters. It's why the Europeans are significantly better in foursomes play over the last 30 years. If you create the conditions for this to be fun, take them to Dumbo, do the New York gangster shoot, hang out at Friar's Head in Shinnecock, put them in houses with chefs, drinking wine deep into the night in the week before, you're more likely to be unified when it matters. You're more likely to be comfortable. You're more likely to be loose. You're more likely to make the putts when the pressure is ratcheted up. And so the United States needs to look at the European template and try to create that. I also, Brandel and I were pushing this Justin Leonard for some time. I think Leonard is a close match for a Luke Donald, just in terms of how organized, how thoughtful, how disciplined he is. And, you know, I think Justin Sneaky, we saw this when he hosted Live From for a couple of years, has a good sense of humor. So what it all adds up to is Europe's better together. They are much better at messaging. They're better at preparing. They're better in the media, and they're better on the scoreboard. I can't look, and I think some of this is cultural, and Eamon probably could speak to this. Europeans just are more inclined to sit at a cafe and drink wine deep into the night. And, you know, I can't tell you how many people said to me, American friends of mine, their favorite players were on the European side. I mean, their favorite week to week, Rory, Tommy, Shane Lowry, Rosie, Ludwig, Victor Hovland, favorite players, guys that you'd want to pop open a bottle of wine with. So it's not as simple as the President's Cup. It's much deeper than just that.
We're already seeing some chatter, Rich, about the idea that, or the expectation even, that Tiger might lead the U.S. team at Adair Manor 2 years from now, which seems to fall into the same trap of always looking for some kind of strongman captain, but never actually developing a plan, never developing a playbook that's portable from team to team. And the Glen Eagles Ryder Cup was a prime example of how you put McGinley with his record against Tom Watson, and it was proof that a team rallies around a player and a leader, not a resume. Do you think America really needs to break away from this idea of choosing a captain based on his individual accomplishments and more so on somebody who actually has a plan or a vision, whoever that might be?
Yes. Emphatically, yes.
Will they do that, though? Look,
I probably not. Probably not. I think it's... Yeah, I don't have much more to say on that. I doubt they'll do it. I think you're absolutely right. Our great friend Paul McGinley is the best example of that. You know, Paul was... You know what... George, you follow baseball, right? Some of the great managers through the years were sort of like utility players. There might have been 240 hitters. I'm thinking of a Davey Johnson or a Davey Lopes, guys like that. You know, they weren't the superstar sluggers. They're the more, they had to be cerebral about the game, tactically on top of things. And that's Paul McGinley will tell you that. And I just would say that that's the reason I consider Paul to be one of the greatest success stories in the history of the sport. You're like, well, why would you say that of a guy who won four times on the European Tour? It's because when he was 19 years old, he was a 5 handicap playing Gaelic football. And 25 years later, he beat Tom Watson at the Ryder Cup. And when I spent the day with Paul out in California in the run-up to that Glen Eagles Ryder Cup about 7 months out, just to get a sense of who he was, this kind of, you know, relatively unknown figure, at least in the United States, I came away so impressed that I wrote a line for the piece. And again, I, with respect to the legendary Tom Watson, whom I greatly admire, I wrote, "Europe, the United States has the legend, Europe has the leader." This isn't about what you did as a player. It's nice. It is, are you up to this particular job? And boy, Luke Donald, you talk about shrewd. You know, and all of it matters, Eamon and George. You know, how you address the world in your opening speech. I remember seeing Luke Donald in the opening ceremony in Rome. and he opened, what was it, the first 30 seconds or so in Italian. We turned to each other in our little trailer and said, U.S. is two down. It just, it's all of a piece, all of it. It's so well thought out. It's so considerate. It's about winning the crowd, winning the media before you step on the field of play to try to win your match. Again, you know, even last night, Paulie shared with us that at the party, Sunday night, Paul sat with Eddie Molinari and Luke Donald for a review because it was fresh in their minds. What did they do wrong? You know, should we have changed the Sunday lineup? Maybe we shouldn't have played Rory and John and Tommy five matches because they were gutted. They were exhausted emotionally and physically exhausted. They're already looking at Ireland. And again, that goes to how sophisticated the operation is, they're never out of business. It isn't like, oh, we lost this Ryder Cup. Let's get a whole new team in here, which is what the United States is going to do. No, the business, this operation that I talked about, sophisticated, holistic, it keeps going. It doesn't stop. It's full time. And it is everything to them. They consider past players. It's part of the reason they didn't take the money. It would have been disrespectful in their view to the players that came before him, to the Eamon Darcy's and the Paul Ways. There's no aspect of this that the Europeans do not thoughtfully consider in ways that we don't. We are really good at the rah-rah. We're good at the, you know, come on, fans, let's go. They're good at the Ryder Cup. Big difference.
Yeah, it's all the small decisions that they make that lead up in these two-year cycles and why they're on this stage and always able to perform. And Rich, to play off your MLB analogy, I'll give you two NBA head coaches, Pat Riley, Phil Jackson, who were bench guys.
Perfect.
Two of the best coaches of all time.
That's it, George.
Really good note there with Paul McGinley. We wish we could spend all show with you. Our producer, Chloe's to say, all right, we got to wrap it up.
Chloe. You sound like, wait a minute, George, you sound like Matt Hegarty. That's not how Chloe sounds. That's Matt Hegarty. You're killing me.
Rich, it was a fun week watching you guys. And thanks for
we had a blast.
Giving us your Ryder Cup recap here on Golf Today.
Thank you, guys. Eamon, I'll see you tomorrow. Show up with your A game.
Joined now by Sky Sports' Andrew Coulter. Andrew was part of the 1999 Ryder Cup on the European side. What was it like through your lens seeing the European performance this past week on the road at Bethpage?
Certainly through the first 2 days, George, it was incredible. They gave it their all. They came together as one unit. They do what they seem to do so well. They left their egos on the plane, and they would absolutely, you know, would do whatever it takes, spill their guts for their teammates, is a saying that we would use over here. I have to say, though, as you mentioned, 99, some horrible feelings were starting to return late on in the afternoon there on Sunday. And thanks to, you know, Lowry, right at the end there, the cup was guaranteed to be coming back on the plane for the Europeans. But it was an unbelievably intensely fought competition. And pure theatre.
That 99 Ryder Cup, Andrew, is remembered for two things. The American comeback, for one, but it's also often held up as the gold standard of bad behaviour by American golf fans. How did that compare to what you saw and heard at Bethpage this week?
Yeah, it's a good question. Look, I mean, because of where I was situated, you could pick up some things across the microphones in commentary. You weren't, because you're not on the ground, you weren't able to hear exactly the type of abuse that were being thrown around, banded around by some of these village idiots. But I think it was probably, they probably still turned it up a notch. I mean, it's notorious in that particular part of the United States. I mean, that's not a reflection of United States sports fans throughout the continent over there. Just more so that area. They were pretty relentless and following, you know, some well-respected journalists and through their Twitter feeds or X feeds and things like that over there. You could tell that, you know, they were pretty upset with some of the stuff that was being thrown out there. I don't know how you stop it, but protocols, I think, have got to be kept in place to try and limit that, to try and minimise the amount of abuse that gets hurled out there. And hopefully, maybe in that regards, this battle at Bethpage Black reached its nadir in terms of that player abuse from spectators.
It seemed like part of what occurred with the Ryder Cup was the fans the first day and a half, or even the first couple days, the energy was so extinguished on the American side by the European performance. When you retroactively look at the moves made on the U.S. side, was there anything that you wanted to double click or highlight on where you thought, okay, that was a strategic misstep or blunder that led to the final margin?
Yeah, great question, John. I mean, first up, when we arrived on site, the strange thing was the golf course setup. There's no way that intimidated any European players. Although, having said that, most of the European players play an awful lot of golf in the United States in any case, so maybe that's not going to play a big part. And historically, over the last few Ryder Cups over there in the States, the golf courses had been set up fairly similar, and you were doing okay, like Whistling Straits, etc. So that was partly one of it. The other one was really a little surprised with, you know, the pairings that first morning, in particular the English Morikawa pairing. Couldn't see that one materialising at all. They weren't the top eight players performance-wise, strokes gained-wise, etc. Over the course of the year. And you know, pretty much, you know, you got to set your stall out right from the off. You've got to go with your top eight. And they weren't, and that was highlighted. And then what was even more surprising was, on the next day, they went again with that. And that smelled of people that don't really know what their function is and what they're doing. It was just incomprehensible to any of us. And trust me, you know, through the grapevine, Eduardo Molinari, when he saw that lineup from the American side, you know, he was unbelievably jubilant before even a shot had been hit. In effect, Europe were almost like one up in some of the matches, and it potentially proved to be a portent for things to come as matchups didn't seem to work out. Americans struggled, you know, they hardly won any holes. The Europeans putted them off the face of the planet. And I don't know whether, as well as maybe playing in front of those Long Island spectators, the Americans were maybe arguably under maybe more pressure than some of the Europeans who came to this match knowing what to expect.
Andrew, something struck me as this whole Ryder Cup played out, that on one side, you know, a lot of the focus was on Keegan Bradley. He was the Netflix captain. He's going to play. He's not going to play. Even in the speeches, so much of the focus was on Keegan, yet every time Luke Donald spoke, he seemed to reference back to the debt owed to generations of European tour players who went before. Does that tell you something about the team, or is it really that simple that the Europeans seem to have some kind of gel as a team that the Americans perhaps don't have?
Very much so, Eamon. Look, I mean, I was trying to figure out the types of questions and the paths that were going to go down, and I was going to say, well, one of the things is get 12 players that want to do it because they're proud to do it for the continent, rather than feel like they deserve to get paid for it. You know, you're talking about multi-millionaires. You're talking about guys that, in their contracts, will have a Ryder Cup place clause in their contracts that they'll benefit from massively in any case. So that argument, again, that focus, that causes a distraction, that gives the opposition side a boost. And that's exactly what's happened. But it is interesting that along that point you're making, Eamon, how the Europeans don't seem to struggle to find partnerships. They have 12 players that will basically play with one another, whereas, you know, the American side are still struggling to find a pairing that they can stick with. Arguably, Cantley and Schauffele, which, personally speaking, I thought they were maybe going to break up. Actually, they had a pretty relatively strong partnership going this Ryder Cup. I thought it had maybe been burnt out, but beyond that, it seems to be very, very difficult to find working partnerships that have an amazing bond and a mutual understanding.
Andrew, I want to dive in more with Luke Donald's captaincy the past 3.5 years. And it was a surprising captaincy in a sense that he wasn't originally tabbed for the 2023 Ryder Cup. It was Henrik Stenson. Now, the argument's being made that he could go down as the greatest European Ryder Cup captain ever, and there's a chance that 27 could be in play. But we haven't necessarily gotten to see a lot of inside the team room, his leadership style, the impact that he has. He's a thoughtful guy, but an understated guy. What can you share?
Well, he's got a lot of very good lieutenants around about him who have a tremendous amount of Ryder Cup experience. He's open to trying new things. He's very learned. He's read an awful lot of books on team bonding, of leadership skills, of things like that. They have a good understanding of what it takes to play at home and away. They have a good understanding of course setups, how that all works. They have a good understanding at who the four ball partners are and who the foursomes partners are. I don't think he leaves any stone unturned. He, for want of a better thing, it looked like maybe Keegan was maybe slightly naive in some things, maybe entrusting so much of it to his data team. But there's no doubt, you know, without giving away any secrets, George, because I quite like the way these results are going, but without giving any secrets, Luke Donald and his team leave no stone unturned. They look at every little aspect and see what they can improve on, see what they can prepare for, and study those and just make it as enjoyable as it possibly can be under the most intense scrutiny and pressure for his 12 players and his team.
The envelope rule was invoked on Sunday as well, Andrew, only the fourth time in recent memory that's happened. When Victor couldn't play, it's a half point and Harris English doesn't get to play. Keegan Bradley suggested afterwards that rule needs to be changed. He seemed quite emphatic about that on Sunday night. That could be dismissed as sour grapes in the moment, but does he actually have a point? Is there a valid argument to be made that kind of settlement of that circumstance isn't valid anymore?
Well, I thought it was a bit, look, the emotions are high and I thought it was a bit of a knee-jerk reaction. We've had an award now the last three Ryder Cups, called the concession, presented by Aon, which is an award for sportsmanship and the way the game is played and the way people play the game, invoking the memories, of course, of Nicklaus and Jacqueline. I think, you know, we've got to understand that these players, you know, they're top-class athletes and they can get injured, unfortunately. And I think the best thing to carry on that trend is respect the nature of it and continue with giving the half point. I felt for Harris in so many ways because I think he was underplayed. I think he was undervalued last week. I think he should have had an awful lot more opportunity. I mean, to find out he was in the envelope, I really felt for the guy because I thought he was much more deserving of a better chance. But, the Americans used that to their advantage. What was it year that Steve Pate had an accident in the car at the middle of the week, and then by the time it went to the singles, he decided he wasn't fit enough to play. So I think the half point, from my perspective, is, you know, the much more sort of sportsmanlike way to deal with that rather than the point. I think it's a bit unfair for whoever it would happen on that they've got to lose the match. And in the sporting and sportsmanship manner of these games, I think the half point is a good way to go about it.
It's an interesting conversation because you referenced Steve Pate, 1991, War by the Shore, and then it happened again in 93 on the European side with Sam Torrance. Lanny Watkins volunteered to sit out for the U.S. side, but the talk of an alternate hasn't happened in 32 years. So we've had three decades plus where this rule hasn't been in play, so who knows what they'll do for 2027 Ryder Cup. Andrew, thanks for hopping on Golf Today with us.
Absolute pleasure, guys. Great to see you. All the best. Keep looking after yourselves.
Fred Funk joins us now. Fred, it's good to see you. First things first, for our past champions chat here, you just had knee replacement surgery. How are you feeling?
Well, I tell you that I had it done in 09 on my right knee, and I didn't remember going through the pain that I went through last week. I had it done on Wednesday afternoon, and I tell you, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I was oof, it was hurting. But I finally turned the corner. It's getting better. I've already started rehab, and I'm going to try to get back as soon as I can. Hopefully next January I can play. I'm going to give the Champions Tour another season, and probably won't be playing full-time, but I love the guys out there. We have a great brotherhood out there, a great fraternity of guys, and I just don't want to give that up yet. So I really enjoy playing out there, and I want to give it one more run.
Yeah, I get it. I was part of the broadcast team in 2022 for that PGA Tour champion season. It's a fun hang, fun crew, and I know for you it's guys that you've been competing against and have friendships with dating back 20, 30, even 40 years. We didn't have to go that far back to show the winning highlights from when you won the Sanderson Farms Championship. We'll start there. The memories that come to mind is you won this event not only once but twice.
Yeah, we were playing Annandale back then before we moved it to Jackson. We were in the other part of Mississippi, and it was a golf course I really liked a lot and obviously played it really well and was able to win it. But it was, everything's changed. The dynamics of everything, how the season runs now and unfolds. Back then when we were going from January all the way to November instead of having a fall season, and then we had the fall season. So everything keeps evolving and developing and redeveloping, and I don't think everybody really knows what's going on at the moment. That could be another discussion, but I always like going there. The people were really friendly, great turnout when we went there. So I have fond memories of there, obviously.
Are you a fan of these changes that you see, Fred? Because obviously now the fall event does take on a great deal of importance for guys who are trying to keep their cards. There's fewer cards out there. There's potential for fewer tournaments. Do you like the direction the tour appears to be moving?
I hate it. I hate the entire direction the tour is taking playing opportunities away from these young kids that are trying to get out there and earn their right to play. I understand, if you really kind of break it down, I consider there's three levels. You got the elevated events, you have the second tier, and then your Korn Ferry events. If they're going to stay with that, which I wouldn't stay with it, but if they're going to stay with that, then in my opinion, you could make it more fair, in my opinion, that you make it a very volatile cut at the end of the year where half the guys, say 35 guys, lose their card on the elevated events, and they move down, and the top 35 from the second tier move up. And the same thing happens with the Korn Ferry guys. You get a huge switchover, turnover each year. But at the same time, you might be losing your card, but you play good that next year, you get rewarded and get a chance to go back and move back up to that higher level instead of only, I consider a guy that finishes 50th or 60th on the elevated events, he played like crap to finish that low. He doesn't deserve the right to be playing for $20 million each week, in my opinion. I don't like the other fact that they're taking cuts away. It always meant so much to make it to Saturday. That's always everybody's thought moving into the tournament. When you teed off on Thursday, you wanted to do everything you can to get to Saturday and Sunday. I don't like that at all. I hate the fact they're taking playing opportunities away. It's disheartening for a lot of these guys. They're working really hard. It's hard to move up through the ranks. It's hard to stay there. If you lose your card, it's hard to get back. I just don't understand it. I'm not sitting in on all the meetings. Just on a Champions Tour, we just got rid of our Q school. I'm not sure I'm a fan of that. I'd like to know all the arguments towards that. But things keep evolving, and I don't really like a lot of the things they've done. I know the LIV Tour is throwing a wrench into everything when that all came about. And the way that was handled, I didn't think was very good, because I think you should have gone to the table. You got to negotiate. You got to at least talk. And there was never any discussion. Whether you consider Greg Norman the face of their tour, you never got to the table with him saying, hey, we got $2 billion. What do you got, Greg? Well, we have $600 billion. Well, you got to say, uh-oh. At some point, you just go, we got to do something. We got to talk.
Yeah, it's certainly been taking up a lot of the oxygen when it comes to the golf world the past 2, 3, 4 years with the launch of LIV and the changes that the PGA Tour has made to quickly evolve in a very short period of time. The Ryder Cup has been top of mind with everyone. We're just a couple days removed from the 45th playing. You played back in 2004. I also have played in a couple President's Cups as well. How much of the Ryder Cup did you see, and what was your reaction to what unfolded?
Well, it was easy for me to sit in front of the TV because that's all I could do all week. So I saw the whole thing. It was amazing. I thought that the same thing exactly happened to us in 04. We got destroyed in the morning matches in the four ball, and it just we never recovered. And it's hard to come back from that. The crowds at Oakland Hills were just quieted down. They actually were rooting for the Europeans more than they were with us. We only had really one. The way I remember it, we had one grouping of, and that was Jay Haas and Chris DeMarco, that played really well. They were our stalwarts of the team. But everybody else just, we just couldn't get any momentum going, and that's what happened this week. And then you see on Sunday that totals flip in mentality, where the Europeans are going out there and they're playing strong and bold and making all their putts and are doing everything they had to do to get this huge lead. And then the mind flips, and this is the way I think it happens in just when you're playing by yourself as well, is that now you're protecting instead of going out trying to win, you're trying not to lose. And I think that's mentality weakened that team a little bit on Sunday, well, a lot of bit on Sunday, where they were just holding on, thinking we have no way of losing this thing. And then it just got tighter and tighter and tighter. And they almost did. And we almost had the greatest comeback ever. But it was exciting. I think there was a lot of things that you can, it's already been discussed. I think one thing is the setup of Bethpage. I didn't play in 02, but I played in 09. And I've always thought, and I think a lot of guys think, that Bethpage is, if not the hardest golf course they've ever played, it's one of the hardest they've ever played. At the same time, it's a very fair golf course. It's hard to have both, where it's very stupidly difficult, but it's still fair. But it requires you to hit certain shots and good shots. And they had the first thing I noticed, obviously everybody noticed how soft it was, but the fairway cut, the rough cuts in the fairways were not really a big issue. And the greens were just so slow and so soft. And it just showed how great the players are nowadays. If they can control where the ball's stopping, I've always said this, a firm, fast golf course is a hard golf course. And one that's like glue, like it was last week, they just light it up and they're shooting 700 and alternate shot and 800. I mean, it's crazy. You don't know on a course like that, that doesn't happen. But you can unpack that and a lot of other things, but it did turn out to be exciting, but it was definitely a deficit that they couldn't really honestly get over that they had after Saturday's matches.
Well, we're glad the Ryder Cup provided you some distraction from the pain of the knee replacement surgery. Fred, we're happy you spent some time with us today. Good luck with the recovery.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Fred.
All righty.
We have Michael Brennan with us now. And Michael, just showing that quick stretch where you ripped off three wins in short succession. What was that ride like?
Oh, it was amazing. The goal at the start of the year was just to try to win a golf tournament. I never really thought that I would win three, or, you know, the three victory promotion was not really in my mind. But very grateful to be able to do it. And very happy with how the season ended up.
You're moving quite methodically through the ranks of various tours early in your career here, Michael. You've now moved on to the Korn Ferry Tour, obviously the aspiration to move to the PGA Tour. Now that you're moving to the Korn Ferry Tour next year, do you automatically find yourself thinking what aspects of your game that you need to improve to compete at that level? Or are you pretty happy with what you've shown this year and you think that's portable to the Korn Ferry Tour?
Yeah, I am happy with how I played this year. I feel like my game was good on any level. That doesn't mean that there aren't areas that I look to improve upon for the following year. I'm definitely going to take some time in the next couple weeks, just going through all my stats from this previous year. I use UpGame as my like stat keeping program, and I'll definitely sit down with my caddy, with my coach, and kind of go through that and look for areas to improve. But having said that, I do feel like the golf that I played these last couple months, you know, would be good enough to compete on the Korn Ferry Tour. And So I'm just going to try to take the opportunity this off season to just tidy up a few things. And I'm really excited to get going next year.
I'm familiar with Up Game. I think the average viewer might be just familiar with marking their score on a scorecard or maybe putts and greens and fairways. Mm-hmm. What are the stats that you dive into that help shape which areas of your game you may need to pinpoint and try and see some improvement?
Yeah, Up Game's great. I mean, outside of the basic strokes gain data that it gives you, things that I look at are kind of dispersion patterns with different clubs off the tee. And for me, that's really helpful when I go to plan a round of golf. My caddy is great at using it. And when we get to like different holes, he'll pull up where my, you know, driver dispersion looks like versus 3-iron, 3-wood, and kind of plan out my round that way. Another really cool aspect of it is I put in the break and the speed of the putt that I hit, so like how far by the hole it goes, and then whether I miss the putt low or high. So I'll be able to see some really cool trends, like, you know, maybe I'm missing all my left to righters low, or I'm hitting them, my uphill putt's too firm or something like that. I don't really know. I don't like to look at the stats in the middle of the season or while I'm playing. I find myself, I'd get a little frustrated if something, you know, wasn't good or something I didn't like. So I've basically just entered a year of stats in, and I'm very, very excited to kind of look at the data and see how we can improve.
Yeah, we heard Scottie Scheffler over the summer talk about how golf's an endless pursuit of chasing perfection. So I understand where you maybe want to save all those stats for the end of the year. The main stat to look at, the three wins. Congrats and continued success on the Korn Ferry Tour.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
We got our guy, Smiley, joining the show now. So, Smiley, you were right in the thick of the action. How would you break down what transpired at the 45th playing of the Ryder Cup?
Hey, man, George. Good morning to both of you guys. Yes, it was just incredible execution from the European team. I mean, they were brilliant. I just hardly saw too many guys miss a shot. You know, so often, you know, guys are a little off here and there. I mean, I watched Justin Rose hit every single golf shot that he hit at the Ryder Cup, and I can count on one hand the amount that were actually hit not in the center and not curving. So just the level of execution still, as I 2 days later just think about this Ryder Cup, is what's sitting with me. The putting executions from these guys the first couple of days. But gosh, the Sunday singles, I don't think anybody expected what we were seeing with all the United States players rising to the challenge and all the matches making it to the 18th hole. It really was a day that I'll never forget. And for a second there, I kind of thought U.S. was going to do it. I don't know if you guys felt the same way, but I'm sitting here looking at the board thinking, I actually think they might win the Ryder Cup at some point today. And I never thought I was going to say that. On Sunday.
There was certainly a period when it looked as though Luke Donald thought that was going to happen as well. Smiley, whenever you look back at the totality of the week, what do you think was more important? Was it the positive decisions that Luke Donald made, or was it some negative decisions, the impact that Keegan Bradley made?
Oh, gosh, you can go both ways there, because the lineups that the Europe put together were just unbelievable. I don't think anybody was beating some of those foursomes teams from Rahm and Hatton. And then also you got Rory and Fleetwood. Those were going to be always a huge, huge challenge to take down some of those teams. But I, with the United States team, I just go to the course setup. You know, that's one of the first things I always look at every week is how the course is playing, how it suits certain players. And the course just was not very difficult at all. The greens just were so soft. The amount of shots that I saw get close to front pins coming from the rough. I mean, that never should happen. Never should happen. And the rough just was not long enough. The greens were too soft. Around the greens, there wasn't enough of a challenge when you did miss the green. So just bogeys were just not on the card for anybody. And, you know, I thought the greens made a huge difference on Sunday. They finally got a little quicker, and then suddenly started to see the Americans make putts. I thought the greens were like perfect make speed on Friday and Saturday. So you just weren't concerned about the ball just rolling too far past or playing that little bit of extra break. And the Europeans putted better, of course, on Friday and Saturday. But I think the green speeds on Sunday was more advantageous to the Americans. But I think you can definitely nitpick some pairings from the Americans on Friday and Saturday. for sure. Especially I was out with Scotty Scheffler and Russell Henley, and I'll never understand why Scotty would ever not be teeing off on the odds. And the advantage that Luving and Fitzy had over Russell Henley and Scotty that morning was paramount. I mean, it was a 30, 40 yard difference every single hole that Russell Henley hit his tee shot. And Russell played as good as anybody from the American team on Sunday. So this isn't a knock at him, but in a foursomes pairing, there was a clear advantage for the Europeans every single time that Russell was hitting off of the same time that Ludwig was hitting as well.
And Smiley, you see, and it can be these really small mistakes, like having a player hit off on odds instead of evens, or running out the same partnership in Harris English, Kawa Morikawa, a second time. And it seems to be a failure of either the analytics of the captain. And I'm not just finger pointing it to this Ryder Cup, but it's happened in 2023 when we lost in 2018. The captain's picks when it combined 2-10 and played really poor. And there were some pairings there that made no sense. Why does it seem to occur repeatedly for the U.S. side?
It's a great question. I think you have to look at, you know, the decisions they're making behind closed doors with stats and the information that they're given, because the data golf had shown that 132nd out of 132nd best pairing in foursomes for the Americans was Colin Morikawa and Harris English. And I could see an argument made that, yeah, I bet both of those guys would be great foursomes players because they're never out of holes. Colin's an incredible iron player. Harris is rock solid and steady. But at some point, you got to look at some data and use it as your guide. And in that case, it just didn't add up, as I would have expected Harris to be playing four ball both afternoons, as he had no foursomes experience in any Ryder Cup. So I felt like the experience and the pairings from the Europe side was their advantage heading into this entire Ryder Cup. And I was interested to see how the Americans were able to piece together pairings that somehow, you know, were the ones that maybe we weren't expecting, to find partnerships that were perfect for this golf course. And I don't think that was quite figured out this week. I think that the Americans still have work to do when it comes to finding partnerships that have players with form that match the golf course, and then also add up from a stat standpoint. And I feel like Europeans definitely outdid them there. As a good example would be Matthew Fitzpatrick. You can look at his record. You saw he's 1-7 heading into this Ryder Cup, but he was put out in foursomes with Ludvig Åberg. And I think we all expected Victor Hovland to play with Ludvig, but Luke Donald put Fitzy out because he was in really good form. And I thought that was a chess piece that it would have been easy for any other captain, if you would have coached that Rome team, to say, wow, I mean, Ludvig Åberg and Victor won 9-7 against Scotty and Brooks Koepka. We have to send them out. That is a pairing we have to send. But to split up Victor and Ludvig and put out a guy like Fitzy, who didn't have the record but had the form, I thought was just an example of really good captaincy from Luke Donald. And you can make the case that was Scotty and Russell the best pairing for the Americans? Were we just running back a firmer golf course in Montreal that seemed to work between two players that maybe wasn't the best setup for this week for how soft the golf course was and how long it played?
Speaking of being agile and adaptive to your circumstances, it was a big week for you, Smiley. You actually made your debut as a hard news reporter at the Ryder Cup. Let's take a look at that video.
Did you hear about my reporting?
No.
So Bones talked about how he was following Rory and Scotty, and that apparently people had snuck in little rubber ducks into the golf course.
Apparently several people in the crowd have smuggled in squeaky baby plastic ducks and are squeaking them as the guys stand over the ball, which was particularly upsetting to Rory there on that 10th tee.
And then I'd gotten some texts from some buddies who had been here earlier in the week. It said, no. That's the limited edition Ryder Cup duck. This duck was on top of the cherry fizz alcohol drink that was served at the golf course all week. And so I got on like our talk back and I'm like, hey, our producer's name is Tommy. I was like, Tommy, they didn't sneak him in. They got him on top of their drinks. He's like, what?
By the way, we are told by our investigative reporter, Smiley Kaufman, that if you buy a cherry fizz drink, you get a squeaky duck toy. It's on top of it. So maybe they didn't sneak them in, but they actually purchased a drink here to get them. That's incredible reporting on Smiley's behalf.
Yep.
That'll be off the menu in Ireland next year.
Yeah. Did he try to drink while he was doing that as part of his research?
He can follow up in a bit.
I just thought that was a hilarious storyline that I never expected today, was to hear about the squeaky ducks.
So, Smiley, how was the cherry fizz drink?
Oh, my gosh. You know, we're going to talk about this Ryder Cup for a long time, but I think we're going to have to talk about it all the way until the rubber duck, pre-rubber duck Ryder Cup, and then post-rubber duck Ryder Cup, because this was an unexpected Sunday storyline that came out of nowhere. And when Bones reported it, I couldn't stop laughing. But then I had this group text of guys who had been out to the Ryder Cup earlier in the week, and they were like, I had that in my drink. And I was like, wait, what? And then I was asking, I was like, please tell me this is accurate, because we're about to report this on NBC. Because if one of my buddies was having a bit in this moment, that would have been a tough scene for me. But luckily, it was accurate information. The service was terrible at Bethpage, so I'm glad my buddies were messing with me and that I didn't get a chance to try it. But if I did, I probably would have had two, Eamon.
Definitely one of the interesting subplots that we had with the fans at Bethpage. And Smiley, I know you're college football fan. You have a unique lens here where you played professional golf. You've walked inside the ropes. You know what it's like as a player. Now you've been a commentator and a broadcaster the past few years. What did you think of the fan behavior at Bethpage compared to either other sports or other golf events? And does there need to be a course correction for the direction the Ryder Cup's heading?
Most certainly. I think there needs to be some form of correction, George. I didn't walk any with worry throughout the week, and that seemed to be where all the bad blood was sent, because I was with Tommy. Tommy Fleetwood is, I think, a lot of Americans cheer for Tommy. I never felt following Tommy that there was any issues. I think at times Justin Rose kind of riled up the crowd a little bit, but he is the Ryder Cup villain from the European team. I don't know, George, it's so hard to say, because I do not approve at all of the behavior of some of the things that I read about, whether it was a drink being thrown or just players really not having the opportunity to go through their pre-shot routine and having players yell, or not players, fans yelling as they're over the golf ball. There's no place for that at all whatsoever. And nor did I see any of that happening in Europe on the call when I was in Rome for the American players. So, of course, you're going to understand that you can't police an entire group of 50,000 plus people. But I hope that when we come back to America, that maybe that there is a way that we can somehow correct all of this, because it's not right for players, when they get over the golf shot, to have to worry about a fan yelling in their backswing or just really just things that they should never be yelled at. So hopefully that gets corrected. I'm interested to see how the response will be from Europe, because I think the players on the European team are already starting to, speak to them and how we want the fans to act. We want you to be loud and proud and cheer for us and don't be so demonstrative towards the Americans, which I don't think has been like a overly big talking point in Europe, but it sure has been in America.
A lot of ugly stuff out there, Smiley, but at least you gave us one of the lighter-hearted moments with your squeaky ducks out there. It's always great to catch up with you. Thanks for the time.
Thanks, Smiley.
Thanks, Eamon. Thanks, George. See you, boys.